Oliver Callan on RTE Radio 1, sponsored by It's For Women. You are not 9 to 5 and neither are we. Conveniently open online 365 days per year, 24 hours per day.
Now, global best-selling author Robert Harris has a brand new novel out, Precipice. It is set in 1914, with Europe on the brink of the Great War, and it tells the extraordinary story of British Prime Minister Herbert Asquith and his obsessive affair with a significantly younger socialite. It's a thrilling story nonetheless, and it uses new research which reveals how this manic romance in many ways threatened Asquith's political career and the security of the empire at a time of war. There's also substantial Irish interest in the story as well, which I'm glad to say, and Robert Harris is with us. Welcome.
Thanks, Oliver. Good to be here.
You've always been fascinated, I believe, by this bizarre entanglement between a 62-year-old Prime Minister, is he?
And yeah, 61. Yeah, it's not 61. Much different. Yeah.
And Venetia Stanley is...
Who's 26 when the novel opens.
26. So you've been reading this for a couple of years? It's been...
Yeah, a long time. Maybe 10 years, perhaps more than that. And Because I found them a fascinating family, the Asquiths. There were so many of them. And I thought maybe I could write a saga about them all. But then I thought that there were too many to follow all the characters. And really, what became more and more interesting to me was this relationship between Asquith and this young woman. He wrote her 560 letters in all. She kept all of them. Sometimes he wrote to her three times a day.
Extraordinary.
And sent her secret information. He was absolutely besotted with her. And he destroyed all the letters she sent to him. And yeah. I realised, simple arithmetic, he liked a letter from her every day. Maybe she didn't make it all the time, but it means she must have destroyed 350 letters. And I thought, well, here's something I can do. I can recreate her side of the correspondence and show her side of the affair.
And it's beautifully done. And the reason you're doing that is because you think she's such a significant figure in British history, if not perhaps European history, that you wanted her kind of story to be told properly.
Yeah, I wanted to write a novel with a strong female character. I wanted to do it for a number of years. And she presented the opportunity because she was no fool. He spent a lot of time with her, took a lot of advice from her because she was very clever. And I thought she did exercise influence clearly. And when she broke off the affair in May 1915, Asquith went to pieces. And literally less than a week later, folded the government and invited the Tories to join him. And there was never a Liberal government again. He was sort of heartbroken. And this has been underplayed by historians. So I think responding to the family who have always, you know, tried to make it sound as though this is a purely platonic affair and not that important.
They've always, historians have dismissed this as an insignificant dalliance.
Yes, Roy Jenkins, who was a great friend of mine, actually, who published a big biography 60 years ago revealing the existence of these letters, said it was no more of a distraction than Lloyd George's hymn singing. Well, it certainly was. I don't think there's any doubt.
And it's all happening at a time of monumental history. I mean, it's almost comic in a way when we're reading his letters, which in the book are his actual letters to her.
All his words, yes.
I mean, give us an idea of just how... it's slightly insane, isn't it, really, the things he's sending to this young woman?
Well, they're all very passionate. They're all my dearest, darling, beloved. One of them ends, do you know how much I love you? No, just multiply the stars by the sands. So there's all this romantic stuff, which Roy Jenkins completely
madness,
left out.
Yeah.
And then he sends his secret information. And another reason I wanted to write the book, actually, is the way they used to get away together was to take an hour and a half drives once a week in his car.
Yeah.
This car is not like a modern car, I discovered when I set out to write the novel. Uh-huh. It had a fixed glass screen between the passengers and the chauffeur. There was a curtain you could draw across this screen. You communicated as the passengers with the driver by a push-button console that lit up on the windscreen, and there were blinds on all the other windows. So now that explains why they went for an hour and a half drive every Friday afternoon. He used to, apart from whatever else happened, he used to show her top-secret telegrams in the summer of 1914. They were called flimsies. They were carbon copies.
I love that detail, yes.
Yeah, and he would screw them up in a ball after he'd show them, throw them out of the moving car window. And these started to be handed in by members of the public in Marlow, in Henley-on-Thames, St James's Park, and only five people received them. They were Asquith, the Foreign Secretary, Sir Edward Grey, Winston Churchill, who was head of the Navy, Kitchener, head of the Army, and the Colonial Secretary. And so there was a leak inquiry.
How sensitive is the information?
sensitive because these are decrypted ambassadorial telegrams, and if the Germans had found them, they would have broken the British diplomatic codes. So it was a serious thing, and I thought, here is where I can invent someone. I'll invent the poor guy who has to go and try and find out why these have started appearing all over southern England. So he's the only, this policeman is the only invented character in the novel.
Yeah, and that adds the thrilling aspect.
Well, it gave me a procedural thing, and it also gave me a way in for the modern reader, you know, that into this extraordinary enclosed world of privilege. She came from a very rich family, all this kind of country house weekend world that they inhabited. He's an outsider looking in.
This is your kind of trademark, isn't it? You've got the truth going on there, and you've got the entertaining side of the fiction. It's education by stealth in many ways, isn't it?
Well, you know, I was a journalist, and for me, there's nothing really beats reality. I mean, you know, and so part of the pleasure of I've found as a writer is to come across stories and then let them kind of sit in my mind for a year or two and see if there's some way that I could write about them. Not all my books are like that, but the last one about the regicides was, and this one is too. The spectacle of this guy in this extraordinary time when they kind of wandered into a war, they didn't know what was going to happen. The novel follows the first 9 months of the war from Asquith's point of view. The telegrams coming across his desk, the cabinet meetings, doesn't go to the front. It's just from the Whitehall perspective. And he sent top secret documents through the open post to her. There were 12 deliveries a day in London in 1940, amazingly. Yeah. And so she, you know, she got cabinet details, she got secret troop movements, you know, he sent it all to her.
In fact, he sends so many documents, sometimes he needs the documents.
Yes. Well, this is part of his downfall, was that he sent her a document from Lord Kitchener saying, I've spoken to the British Army in France and they have enough shells for their next attack. There'd been a great scandal about the shortage of ammunition. And he made a speech to 5,000 ammunition workers in Newcastle saying, there's never been a shell shortage. And then, of course, he realised he'd got it wrong. He was just saying the next attack they'd be all right. So he'd sort of lied to the country.
Extraordinary. The newspaper coverage of this novel, very unusual for a novel, are about revelations, discoveries of true history, literally saying that this is the first time people have discovered the details. Why is that? Because these letters were sort of known.
Well, yes, they were. They were discovered after Venetia Stanley's death in 1948. They were discovered by her daughter, Judy, and she realised their importance. She had no idea of her mother's affair with the Prime Minister. So then she owned the physical letters, but the Asquith family controlled the literary content.
Right.
She told the family about it. They made transcripts. They gave them to Roy Jenkins, but under certain conditions. So he played down the affair, quite frankly. That was in 1964. 1982, a scholarly edition of half the letters was published. But again, they were at pains to suggest this was not a physical affair, which frankly is nonsense, given the nature of the two individuals.
You've just described the bedroom on wheels.
Yeah, the bedroom on wheels, which no one else had ever taken the trouble to discover. So, and then there are letters, important letters, which are missing, in particular the last two paragraphs of the novel, where Asquith explicitly says he might well not have formed a coalition and folded the Liberal government if only she had been around to advise him, because he relied on her judgment. He felt he could trust her in a way that he couldn't trust other colleagues, I think.
Good Lord. The relationship itself is kind of shocking in any era, really, isn't it? Because he's a man in the 60s. He's married. He's on his second marriage.
Yes, he has he has seven children.
He's seven children. And one of those children is... this is how he knows Venetia Stanley, I presume, because she's friends with his daughter.
His daughter, Violet, they were best friends, Violet and Venetia. So, yes, in the modern era, it would be... I mean, it would have been a huge scandal in 1914. But these days it would have been a completely career-ending scandal immediately. And, of course, it would have come to light. But Asquith could travel in the novel. He goes on train journeys, walks through the streets, completely unrecognised, even though he's been Prime Minister for, what, 6-7 years by this point. Mm. So he was able to get away with it in a way that no politician would be able to do now.
And Venetia Stanley, she's very interesting because she's very rich. She's from a very wealthy family. They have houses all around the place. And we have great fun in the novel visiting each of some of the parties they go. Very spoiled.
Yes, very spoiled. A woman looking for a purpose in life. She drifted around a kind of rakish society set known as the coterie. She, I think, liked to shock her family. They half guessed what was going on, I think. I think she liked the risk of it. I think it's important to say she's no victim, in my view. I think she was a strong person, and when she got bored with Asquith, she moved to finish the relationship. So she was always, to a degree, in control. It wasn't like he was her boss and she was a secretary and he was predatory. She was a social superior in many ways.
And in the novel, she's kind of exasperated by the sheer volume of letters having to reply
To begin, yes.
She's doing nothing, but the Prime Minister is sending so many letters.
Yeah, to begin with, I think, you know, it amused her. But as the war turned worse and worse for the British, he became more and more desperate and started sending her letters three times a day. He'd like to wake up to a letter from her on his bedside table. He'd write to her at the end of the morning and tell her what had happened in Cabinet. At the end of the afternoon or early evening, he might walk to his club, the Athenaeum, sit in the library with a whiskey and soda and write to her about what had happened during the day. And then at midnight, lying in bed, he'd scrawl a pencil letter to her. So he was sending her three letters a day. Well, she simply couldn't cope with the flow, I don't think, and started to look for ways of getting out of this.
It's just incredible, given the backdrop of what's
going on.
Oh,
yes, and given the thing really comes to the part that's shocking is the way that the terrible Dardanelles expedition, which the Allies launched, that the British alone lost 32,000 men, British and Irish, I should say, because, of course, Irish were fighting at that time, and 110,000 men died in all. And at the crucial meeting where Churchill presented the plans and this was agreed, he spent half an hour of that meeting, we know, writing to Venetia. 3:30 p.m, my darling, I'm in a war council meeting. I'll pick you up next Tuesday from Cynthia's. Oh, I see, no, it's the following Tuesday that you're at Cynthia's. So clearly he's got his diary.
Incredible.
Then it goes on 4 p.m, Winston talking. Very interesting. We'll tell you all about it when I see you. So we have a sort of minute-by-minute record of his distraction.
If you made it up, we wouldn't believe it.
No, exactly.
Because Winston Churchill is a significant character in this. He's about 40...
Yeah, he's 39, I think.
He's liberal at this stage.
Yes.
And he's the First Lord of the Admiralty. And, of course, he's very involved. He's scapegoated, really, isn't he, for that failed attack on Constantinople?
Yes, he is. Although he was certainly the prime mover of it, and he was the one who wanted to keep pressing on with it, even as it got more and more mired in trouble.
Even when he knew he didn't have the troops.
It was crazy. I mean, we were trying to do it with 1,500 men, take Constantinople, ended up sending 80,000, I think it was, and losing a lot of ships. And just, it was like Vietnam, really, for the Americans. We never had a clear objective. We never asked ourselves how many men it would take. So that was stupendous folly. And Churchill was very belligerent. He wanted the First World War. I mean, he was keen for it. Whereas another character in the book, who I really enjoyed writing, Lord Kitchener, warned Asquith right from the start, because everyone's saying, oh, it's going to be over by Christmas. They went in almost light-hearted. But he said, when he was asked how long the war would last, he said, well, it'll last till 1917 at least, because we need to raise an army of 2 million men, and that will take us 3 years.
He predicts every step, really, doesn't he?
Yeah, he knew what he was talking about, and he didn't want to be Secretary of State for War, because he knew what was coming.
He was trying to go back to Egypt.
Yes, he was Consul General in Egypt, and that was a much more cushy and agreeable billet than being in charge of the British Army.
He's a fearsome character here. You mentioned the Irish question is very prominent in the story as well, because, of course, that's the build-up to World War One. And is this the first time you've featured Ireland? There's even the scene in Dublin.
Yes. There is Ireland, obviously, in the book I wrote about Cromwell and the Regicides. A drive-by shooting, I suppose one would describe that as.
A novel that confused Irish readers, you have to say. Which side are we on, the Royalists or Cromwell?
Exactly. But this Ireland is important here because in the summer of 1914, all the British political establishment could think of was home rule for Ireland, which the Irish nationalists who propped up the Liberal government were insisting was introduced. And so when the Archduke was assassinated in Sarajevo and the international crisis began to blow up, there was some sense, some people were relieved because it would mean the Irish Emirate could be postponed yet again.
Yeah.
But Venetia wrote a very good letter to Asquith, which I'm able to put in the book because we know it. She said, that's like saying the best way to cure a headache is to cut off your head.
Yeah.
And he says, I liked that remark. So it gives you a flavour of how funny she was and clever.
Very smart.
Yeah.
He even comes back from his trip to Dublin and tells her casually, you pick the next...
Oh, yes. Lord Aberdeen was the viceroy. I mean, I did find this weird because he really engineered the trip to Dublin to speak to a mass audience to raise morale and troops because it meant that he could stay with her and her family near Holyhead
that
on the way out
astounding.
And on the way back.
Yeah. So he travels all the way to Dublin just so he can stop on Holyhead, which is where her kind of summer home is.
Yes, and
that's
extraordinary. But it was really weird for me to write about him staying at the Viceregal Lodge in
yes.
Phoenix Park and to think that this...
It's now the building where the President of Ireland
yeah,
lives.
Yeah, and this is not that long ago. I mean, it's no. just extraordinary. So this is the last real flickerings of the great Victorian imperial project.
And Irish historians particularly would be delighted with the mention of an often forgotten shooting which happens on Bachelor's Walk in Dublin on the Quays here in 1914 with the Scottish Borderers, is it?
Yes, so that was another great bit of chaos for Asquith to deal with because at this time, following the Curragh Mutiny, he was not only Prime Minister, he was also Secretary of State for War, so he had to withdraw the soldiers that had fired on the crowd and then there was a debate where they came off pretty badly, the government. They were mauled by the opposition. So, yeah, Ireland was his great preoccupation.
Mm-hmm.
And this other huge conflict was a sort of small dark cloud on the horizon that suddenly became enormous.
I love that line where you say politics is just replacing one problem with another.
Exactly. There's just
one hell of a problem.
And the next one, please. Yes, they come over the hill one after the other.
Yeah, but there's extraordinary detail about dealing with the dreary parishes of Fermanagh and in Tyrone as well, because the Ulstermen come calling on Asquith. By the way, incidentally, on that shooting that happened in Dublin, I was reading, I think three or four people died. One of the people shot is the father of a very famous folk singer in Ireland, Luke Kelly.
Really?
He was in the Dubliners. So extraordinary kind of Irish connections.
Yeah.
It's things like the Flimsies and also the door on Downing Street is green in this
The year. Door was green. There was no security. You could walk up to Downing Street. He would be fumbling with his key to go in. He was known as Squiffy because he liked to drink on top of everything else. And and they had a kind of 20 servants in Downing Street and it was just such a vanished era. Taxi drivers didn't know where Downing Street was.
And he uses just normal taxis.
Yes, there's a great scene in it, again true, where he, in a desperate attempt to avoid war, a telegram comes in from the Kaiser complaining about the Tsar, and he suddenly thinks, oh, this is at midnight, and he suddenly thinks, oh, maybe we could persuade the Tsar to stop mobilisation. So he scrawls a reply from the King, goes to Downing Street, goes from Downing Street, hailing a cab to Buckingham Palace, wakes up the King at 1 o'clock in the morning, who comes down in his dressing gown, shows him the telegram, the King puts it to the Kaiser, to the Tsar, the King puts Dear Nicky at the beginning of it and Yours Georgie at the end.
Because they're cousins.
Yes. And Asquith staggers back to his bed and lies awake at 2 o'clock in the morning thinking of Venetia as he writes to her. I mean, it was a gift, really, for a novelist, the whole thing.
I have to say, you, probably because of your background, which you're very, very proud of, you grew up in a council estate in Nottingham, is that correct?
Yes.
There's quite a lot of coverage of these people having a fine time dining, picnics on the beach, just constantly doing nothing, really. I mean, and the fictional bit gives us a nice kind of snarky coverage, which is spot on, about the gardeners earning threepence
an hour. Yeah, I needed that framing, I realised. Otherwise, everyone just takes this world for granted and the modern reader would just recoil from it. So I needed this character who's got them under surveillance, is investigating their relationship, intercepting their letters, to give us some perspective to the story. Yes, that character is me, really, or all of us, looking astonished, mouth open, at what these people are getting up to.
Yeah, with the gates all closed and because their world does change.
Oh, yes. I mean, it's haunting, actually. The the Venetia Stanley's family, they had a 64-bedroom mansion in Cheshire, Alderley Edge.
Yeah.
They had a huge castle, Penrose, next to Holyhead, and they had a huge mansion in London off Portland Place. Only the mansion in London survives. The rest were wow. all gone soon after the, you know, after the 30s. The whole economic system that supported that way of life collapsed. This is the last glimpse of these people before the clouds roll in and the Edwardian summer days are gone.
Yeah, it's just lovely the way you blend that in, almost subtly. And by the way, we're giving a lot away about history here, but
yeah.
there's still quite a lot of action because you've got Paul Deemer, the detective.
I've got the policeman and
whose
also...
His brother is at the front.
His brother's at the front, and really, it's just watching these characters. They're like characters on the deck of the Titanic, really, that's just starting to go down, something that happened during when Asquith was Prime Minister.
Oh, yeah.
And really... I became very fond of her and interested in her and her desire to escape from the constricted life she was obliged to lead.
You had a lot of journalistic fun with this one.
Yeah, yes, I know, especially I felt like a News of the World man, really, when I was investigating the car.
Yes. We have
and trying to
the
imagine what was happening in the back of it. But it's sort of prurient in a way, but history turns on these sorts of affairs and the longings and the passions of people in those huge jobs are no different from those of ordinary people. Indeed, they may be more intense because they're more intense individuals.
Venetia Stanley, she obviously has family descendants that are around.
She has one granddaughter.
Does
left.
She?
Yes.
Do you know what she's made of the story?
She's very enthusiastic. She helped me a lot, actually,
really?
And gave me permission to use the letters. And I'm doing events publicising the book with her. Her name's Anna Mathias. She's extremely nice. Her mother died young when she was still a child, and she's the only one left. It's rather a sad, you know,
yeah.
end to the whole story.
Especially such a remarkably intelligent woman that Venetia was. Anna Mathias told The Observer she was completely delighted with the novelistic treatment because it brings her relative to life. The Observer, by the way, an old haunt of yours?
Yes. I was political editor of The Observer and I learned a lot, which has helped me, you know, in writing the novels over the years. I'm a journalist, still a journalist at heart, really. Most of my friends are journalists from the time when I worked at the BBC all the time and newspapers.
Journalist through novel form. or something.
Yeah, I just find them their company more conducive than that of novelists, to be honest.
It seems like you missed the job of journalism and that's why you kind of are still doing it in this way.
No, I don't, to be honest with you. I did journalism and I got a lot out of it, but I never enjoyed it nearly as much as writing novels. I think I was a novelist working as a journalist rather than as a journalist who turned his hand to writing novels, if you know what
yes,
I mean.
Yeah.
This was always what I was going to do. I think that was a preparation for this.
It says on Wikipedia you were 30 when you became the political editor of The Observer. Is that correct?
Yes. Well, actually, I was 29, but I'm not. It seems immodest to point that out.
I think I've got every age wrong by a year so far.
Well, Wikipedia
29.
Is wonderful, but, you know, there are
not to be trusted, which is why I was fact-checking. That's a remarkable success.
Well, thank you. I mean, I was started young, 21. I went to work at the BBC straight from university. I did that for 8 years. And then Anthony Howard, a great journalist who was deputy editor, said, did I want to come and do the political job? Because I'd written biography of Neil Kinnock and I'd sort of always followed politics. So I went and did that for 2 years. And then I moved to the Sunday Times as a columnist. Mm. I wasn't a very good news reporter, to be perfectly honest.
Really?
You know, big stories would be going on under my nose and I'd be sort of wandering around with a book.
You're able to spot stories now that have been ignored for 100 years.
Yes, this is more the pace I can work at.
Okay. Was everyone in your family as successful as you? Were you all...
Well, not really. I mean, insofar as I was the only member of my family who ever went to university, I was the first to go.
Right.
And so I was a bit of an outlier, really. I owe a lot to my mother and father, huge amount, because they both left school at 14, but they were both very intelligent and both. So we grew up in a house where books were read and they took us to exhibitions and museums and, you know, they were aspirant working class, if you know what I mean. And nowadays, of course, they get much more of a chance. In those days, they didn't.
What did they do?
My father was a printer, so my earliest memories really are sitting behind these huge presses on a Saturday morning, playing with huge sheets of paper that he let me use. I think that's very much partly why I became a writer. I had the smell of printer's ink in my nostrils from childhood. And my mother was just a housewife, you know, stayed at home.
She worked at home.
Yeah.
Your dad, he got polio, was it?
He had polio when he was a baby, when he was 18 months, and they tried electric shock treatment. And all, I mean, it must have been awful for him.
Dreadful,
he got it in the same epidemic as Franklin D. Roosevelt in the 1920s. So that affected his life. It meant he could never really play sport. He was a strong swimmer, but otherwise he couldn't play sport. So we never had that. You know, he was never, we never tossed a ball around or anything like that.
Oh,
we talked about politics and... famous story in the family that when I was 6 years old, you know, there was a parents' evening, and my parents came to see examples of work which were pinned up around the classroom, and everyone else, what we did in our holidays or my pet hamster and so on. My essay was called Why Me and My Dad Don't Like Sir Alec Douglas Hume. And in a way, I went on writing that in the Observer and the Sunday Times ever afterwards.
You've been very, very fortunate, haven't you, with the screen treatment of your work?
Yes, I have. I've had nine, you know, things turned into films or TV series, and most of them have been pretty good. And the forthcoming one, Conclave, looks like it might be the best.
This
of
is going
all.
To be, isn't it?
Yes, it's one of those things that is a great thing that can happen to you completely. Yeah, I mean, it follows the novel very closely.
The papal thriller,
yeah.
People will know.
Yes, it's with Ralph Fiennes as the kind of dean of the College of Cardinals, and Stanley Tucci is in it, and Isabella Rossellini is the nun.
John Lithgow. There's an Irish actor in there, Breen F. O'Byrne.
Yes, and it is directed by the director who did All Quiet on the Western Front, who
Edward
won the Oscar.
Barker. You must be thrilled when he came on board.
Yeah, it was just a sort of... everything kind of came together. It's taken 8 years, I would say, incidentally, and people have been attached to it and gone away from it. But it has a very good producer, Tessa Ross, who was determined to see it through. And there we are. So, yeah.
The trailer looks amazing.
The trailer is fantastic. I saw it a year ago when it wasn't quite finished. I haven't seen the final finished version yet.
That's coming out in November, so right in time for award season. That's how confident they are.
They seem to be very confident about it. I get very superstitious. I sort of cross my fingers and touch wood and whistle tunelessly whenever people talk about things like that.
But you must get quite a buzz.
Yeah, it's great. It's like being a grandfather, which has just happened to me. You know, it's handed to you and then you can hand it back. You know, you sort of... I'm responsible and yet curiously not responsible. So it's the best sort of relationship.
It's akin to being a granddad. That's
quite a
high compliment. Precipice is made for a movie.
Well, let's hope. I haven't sold it yet. So if there's any film producers out there listening...
because Munich, of course, which is Jeremy Irons.
Yes.
As Peace in Our Time, Neville Chamberlain. That was very, very well received, wasn't it?
Yeah. As you say, I have been fortunate. You know, things can go wrong. I didn't think much of Fatherland, to be honest with you.
But
Enigma, the Tom Stoppard did the screenplay, and, you know, I think that's a pretty good film.
Precipice is the first time you've tackled the Great War?
Yes, it is.
It is. I'm surprised by that.
I've never set a book there before. And it's different. It's not kind of barbed wire trenches and all of that. It's the politics, the diplomacy that tries to avoid it, and then the politics and the strategy as the whole thing starts to go terribly wrong.
It's the best treatment of history because it has our kind of jaws dropping and almost laughing darkly at it. And yet it's real.
Yes, and I worried about writing characters like Kitchener, but when it came to it, because I'm writing from Asquith's point of view, these characters come in out of the room and go out of the room, and I just follow what he thinks of them, see them through his eyes. And Kitchener, six foot two, the great imperial soldier
he'll
with
be hard
staring
to cast.
Blue eyes because he's had some accident.
Kenneth Branagh on stilts, maybe.
Yes, I don't know who can be him. Asquith's wife, Margot, who we haven't mentioned, who was
quite
a formidable
character.
Woman, she said of Kitchener, not a great man, but a great poster. This is a typical Margot Asquith remark.
She gets great lines in this. Yes. Okay, so, and some of them are true, heard on the dinner table. Robert Harris, thank you so much for your time. I enjoyed our conversation. It's called Precipice. It's already out and about. You don't have to do much to push these things anymore, surely. Enjoy your trip to Dublin. Thank you so much.
Yeah, thank you. Bye-bye. Lovely.